Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interest in every way. Now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. Our program is coming to you tonight from the Park Plaza Hotel in New Haven, where the 1975 convention of SAVE, the Society of American Vintage Radio Enthusiasts, is being held. The organization was founded some 5 years ago by Sal Trapani and attracts collectors of old radio shows from up and down the East Coast. Special guests this year include Irene Wicker, known to millions of children in the late 1930s as the Singing Lady. Also here tonight are Ann Elsner, who played Stella Dallas for almost 20 years on NBC Radio, and Rosa Rio, who was the studio organist for so many popular radio shows of the 30s and 40s, in addition to starring on her own radio show. Many of you will remember Rosa as our guest here on the Golden Age of Radio about 4 years ago. My colleague and radio historian Ed Corcoran is about to introduce a fourth radio personality of the past who is attending this gathering and whose voice is familiar to all of you. Ed is at the head table, surrounded by a good many fans of old-time radio. So, Ed, over to you for the introduction of tonight's special guest here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Thanks for the audience here.
Oh, no,
not.
We're going to get that in.
I don't know how you get it.
Hi, this is Ed Corcoran speaking to you from the SAVE Convention, and we have another very famous guest with us this evening. We have the man who made Casey Crime Photographer a household word. We're referring to Mr. Stutz Cotsworth.
Well, I was wondering about that household word, but because it's not that easy a word to remember, for one thing, and I would like to have thought that Casey became that familiar to people that it became a household word, but I don't think that's true. I think...
Well, it was in my house anyway. Let's put it that way.
Well, I used to love to run into people who would say, well, we heard your show the other night. And I'd say, oh, how'd you like it? And say, well...
Well, I never felt that way. Well, before getting into Casey and that wonderful show that we all, I remember at least, and I'm sure most of our audience does, you're certainly a well-established actor on the stage many years before getting into radio. I wonder whether we could just briefly go into your background, maybe you'd take a job in radio.
Well, all right. Well, I can tell you very briefly. I became an actor in 1932. With the Civic Repertory Theater of Eva Legagin at the old Civic Repertory down on 14th Street and 6th Avenue. And I became an apprentice, and I learned my trade, I learned my business, and later on I became a member of the company. And I was in very good company, I might say, at that time. Some very wonderful people were in that company, like Burgess Meredith and Parker Fenley, Alexander Scorby. So, time goes on and I have to work. And so I did several plays on Broadway, and they weren't very good. And I wanted to do some radio, but I didn't know how to get into it. So a friend of mine who was in a play with me, a play called Macbeth, with Maurice Evans and Judith Anderson, Her name was Abby Lewis. She was a go-getter after radio. And she said, "Stotts, you have a fine voice, and there's no reason in the world why you shouldn't do some radio." And I said, "Well, I don't know these people. I don't know how to go about getting it." And she said, "All right, let me give you a list." And damn, she didn't. She gave me a list of about 10 or 15 people. And the next thing you know, I had a running part on Pepper Young's Family. And I was beginning to like this radio bit, you know, because I found it very easy. One uses one's imaginative powers to create a picture out of whole cloth, which has no basis in truth, whatever, except the words. And if you can make it sound as though you meant it, if you can make it sound as though it was important, you're in, you see. All right, I was in after a while. And I got to know these wonderful people like Virginia Payne and Kenny Delmar and Parker Finley and Peter Donald and all these lovely, lovely people, Jackson Beck, Arnold Moss, Mary Jane Higbee, Guy Sorrell, Johnny Gibson. Did you say something about you had a thing with Johnny Gibson?
No, I think we got the last interview that he actually ever gave.
Johnny was just naturally funny, you know. He thought funny. Then John Dietz, who was our director on Casey Crime Photographer. Johnny Dietz was the same. He was tired of the same stick. He was a little bit pixelated too, you know.
This was the only show where a photographer really was in preeminent. Whenever there was a story that broke in the town, they wouldn't call the reporter or the city editor. They'd call you all the time. You had a reel in there with the police department and everybody else, didn't you, on that show?
Well, actually, yes, I had an in with the police department with Lieutenant Logan. But it wasn't that. It was just that I wanted to stick my nose in everything, that's all. And also, I found that if you got photographs or something or other, you had sometimes prima facie evidence, you know, which could solve the whole damn crime.
Ed and Stotts, I'm sure our listeners are anxious to hear Casey, crime photographer at work solving crimes. So, let's go back about 30 years or so for Stotts Cotsworth in Casey, crime photographer.
The Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation brings you Crime Photographer.
Hiya, Casey. What's the good word?
Framist on the Cranus Ranch.
Framist on the Cranus Ranch? Huh? Hey, what kind of talk is that?
That's double talk. Huh, Tony?
Well, I don't know anything about double talk, but I know good single talk when I hear it.
What's good single talk?
Anchor Hawking is the most famous name in glass. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tony Marvin. Every week at this time, the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation of Lancaster, Ohio, and its more than 10,000 employees bring you another adventure of Casey, crime photographer, ace cameraman who covers the crime news of a great city. Our adventure for tonight, the blonde lipstick. O'clock in the evening at the Blue Note Cafe. It's too early for the late crowd, and the daily crowd has gone on to dinner. The place is practically deserted when...
Hi, Ethelbert!
Greetings, Ethelbert!
Casey, Miss Williams.
Two bottles of beer, pal.
Coming up. they are, Casey. I was hoping you'd drop in.
And why? What's up?
Well, there was a dame looking for you.
A dame? Who was she?
I don't know her name because she didn't mention it, but she really wasn't no dame. She was class.
Class of 1898?
Well, no, Miss Williams, she was young. And when I say a girl has class, I mean she had... Well, it's not what she had, it's the way she used it. You know, class.
I take it, Ethelbert, she was good-looking.
Yeah.
What'd she want with me?
I don't know, Casey. Not that I didn't inquire. She comes in and asks me if I would point out Casey, the photographer for the Morning Express.
Uh-huh.
With a note of regret in my voice, I says I would if I could, lady, but Casey ain't among those present.
Oh, then you probably said, is there anything I can do for you, lady?
Yeah, how'd you know?
Well, you told me she was very pretty.
Sure. Now, wait a minute, Casey. I wasn't trying to cut in on you. I only asked her, is there anything I can do for you? And she says to me, oh, no. I wanted to see Mr. Casey. It's rather personal. So I told her you'd be around about this time, and she said she'd come back.
So you don't know her angle?
She didn't have no angle, Miss Williams. So she sounded more like she admired Casey from afar.
Well, don't choke, Annie. What's so funny about that?
Oh, be your age, Casey.
Well, she did tell Ethelbert that her business was personal.
Oh, and the way she said it. Men can tell about things like that.
Well, it might be a case of hero worship, you know. Lots of girls go for big names. Well, stick around and see. Maybe after all, I'm not a...
Casey.
What? What's the matter, Ethelbert?
She's here. And the one near the door.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what I said when I first seen her. Shall I call her over?
Ethelbert, do not delay fate.
Okay. She sees me. She's coming over.
Annie, how do we look?
Well, nothing wrong, but a tailor and a barber couldn't fit.
Right here, miss. This is Mr. Casey I'm pointing to, but I didn't get your name.
My name is Laura Neely, Mr. Casey. I hope you'll excuse me, but I just had to meet.
That's a pleasure, Miss Neely. This is Miss Williams, an acquaintance.
Yes. Mr. Casey has no friends. Oh, I read that honest newspaper men can't afford to make friends. Oh, you're just as I pictured you, Mr. Casey.
Really? Don't go building up any romantic ideas about me, Miss Neely.
Oh, but it's true. Well, you reach the public every day. You have great power for good or evil, for influence.
Oh, for goodness sake.
You wanted to see me about something? Something personal, Miss Neely?
Oh, yes, Mr. Casey. It's very personal to me.
Oh, that's all right.
You see, I want some publicity.
Publicity? Oh.
You see, I'm working for a certain charity, Mr. Casey, and I know that if you give me publicity with pictures in the newspaper, I'm bound to collect a lot of money.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Don't you think, Mr. Casey?
Not at the moment, Miss Neely. I think Mr. Casey is nursing a case of severe disappointment.
Pardon me?
Is that what you've been hanging around for? Some free publicity?
Oh, but it's not for myself, Mr. Casey. It's for a worthy cause.
Oh, I know. I know. The old story. How do you want your picture? In a bathing suit?
Oh, Mr. Casey, you don't understand. This is a very worthy cause.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Sure, yeah. Getting a picture in the paper is the first step in interesting some movie producer. No, I'm sorry, Miss Neely. No go.
Oh, you really got me all wrong. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the City Welfare Fund, and I thought that as a newspaper
what did
man...
What you say?
I'm working for the City Welfare Fund. I think everybody should help.
Oh, why didn't you say so instead of beating around the bush?
You mean you'll help?
Well, I'll be glad to help with the City Welfare Fund anytime.
Oh.
But every newspaper's collecting for the fund. What's your special angle?
Well, you know how people are, Mr. Casey. They intend to send a contribution, but they just never get around to it. But I call on them after work, and they're glad to give.
Would you give all your time to collecting?
Oh, as much as I can. You see, I work for the Stevens Electrical Company.
Huh?
After work, I visit people evening.
That's not a bad angle, no? Look, I'll do a series of shots of you getting donations from prominent people. Annie, look, how does this strike you? I'll snap Laura getting a donation from Logan behind his desk at police headquarters.
I'm filled with enthusiasm at the novel.
Good, we'll start right here and now. Come on, Ethelbert, kick in. Hello, Annie. How's the news department?
We're fine, Casey. One murder, two arsons, and a nightclub fight between two movie stars. In other words,
I'm not writing up that baby-faced face grabber.
Now, Annie, she's collecting for the city welfare fund.
Collecting a lot of glory for herself.
Well, so what? She's working for it, isn't she? Every newspaper guy I sent her to has made a donation, even though he's already given before. You know that Laura's collected over $10,000 already?
There must be that perfume she was sporting. Twilight in Paris. Guaranteed to land your man.
Oh, look, why don't you give the gal a break, Annie? She's okay.
Oh, is she? Oh, I've tried, Casey, but I don't go for her.
Well, why not? The way you hate her...
Oh, I don't hate her.
All right, the way you dislike her, then. Well, there isn't any reason for it.
I knew I'd dislike her before I met her.
Now, that's what I mean.
Williams, city room, police desk.
May I speak to Mr. Casey, please?
Now, just a moment. For you, Casey.
Huh? Oh, don't get up. Hello, Casey speaking.
My name is Thomas Stevens, Mr. Casey.
Huh?
President of the Stevens Electrical Company.
It sounds familiar, Mr. Stevens. But,
Miss Laura Neely is my secretary.
Oh, yes. Laura mentioned you.
And she told me about you, Mr. Casey. You've been helping her collect funds for the city welfare fund.
Well, Laura does all the work, really.
But you are very much interested, aren't you, Mr. Casey?
Naturally, I want to see the fund get as much as possible.
And I'd better tell you, Mr. Casey, I really don't know whether I should call the police or...
The police? What happened?
There may be nothing to it, but on the other hand, Laura left the office with over $10,000 in cash, which she was going to take to the bank.
When? What time?
During her lunch hour. That's 1 o'clock.
That's 4 hours ago.
Yes, yes. She hasn't returned. I didn't think anything of it at first, but then I began worrying.
Well, did you check with the bank? Did Laura deposit the money?
I called the bank, but she hasn't been there. I'm afraid she's... it could have been an accident or anything, but she had $10,000 with her. What shall I do? Call the police?
No. Hold everything for a while. I'll check this end, and I'll call you back in an hour.
All right. Goodbye, Mr. Casey.
Goodbye.
Hey, I only heard your side of the conversation, Casey, but it doesn't sound good.
It's say not. Laura Neely left her office for the bank with more than $10,000 in donations at 1 o'clock. It's after 5 now. She never got there.
Huh. Check the bus and railroad terminals.
Huh? Hey, wait a minute, Annie. That's unfair. Really. Laura wouldn't run off with that dough.
No, I'm catty. But where's Laura? And more important, where's that $10,000?
Yeah, that's what worries me. Laura could have been followed and robbed.
Casey, I'm working a police desk, remember? I'd be the first one to get a report on a robbery or assault.
Well, she might be hurt, Annie. She may be unconscious in some hospital right now.
You know I get the accident reports, too, and nothing doing, Casey. Now, you better start thinking up excuses.
Excuses for what?
I'll state the case as simply as I can. You meet a girl at the Blue Note. You don't know a thing about her.
Wait a minute. If I can't judge a person's character after all these years...
Stick to men, Casey. You don't know a thing about women. I should know. I haven't been able to teach you a thing.
Like what?
Well, we'll go into that some other time. Right now, you've accepted a strange girl at face value. You introduce her to all your newspaper friends. You practically force them to give her money. What does that make you with all the boys? The biggest sucker in town.
Well, I'll still bet my last dollar that Laura's honest.
Face the facts, Casey. You were taken for a ride. Now, what are you going to tell the boys?
Nothing.
Oh, well, they'll be telling you plenty.
Well, not until they find out. Look, so far, her boss, Stevens, is the only one who knows that Laura's missing. That gives me a chance to find her.
Well, you'll need police help.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it will at that.
Well, I'll ring up Logan.
Well, look, Annie, give me the phone. I'll talk to him.
Maybe you better let me do it. You did get Logan to pose for a picture with Laura. And it won't look very well when the story breaks.
I'll take my own medicine if I have to. Still not sold in the idea that Laura ran out, though. Hello, police headquarters. Hello, Logan. This is Casey. Now listen carefully and save your comments until I'm through. Laura Neely has disappeared with over $10,000 she collected.
Come in, Miss Williams.
How are you, Captain?
Fine. And who's the gentleman with you?
Oh, cut the comedy, Logan.
The gentleman is Mr. Casey.
Impossible.
Oh? Why, Captain Logan?
Because a certain photographer named Casey wouldn't dare show his face around here, not after what he's done to me.
Go ahead, rub it in.
Now, what'd you expect me to do, roll out the welcome mat for the guy who's made me the laughing stock of the police department? Every paper in town's going to dig up the picture of me handing a donation to Laura Neely. And are they going to go to town? Quote, Captain Logan gives official sanction to Bunko Game, unquote.
Now, hold on, Logan. I'll admit it looks bad for Laura.
Oh, and you'll also admit that Hitler might have been guilty, I suppose.
When you cut the sarcasm, we might get to work. Laura disappeared. She was carrying 10 grand. Well, now, lots of guys in this town could knock her off for less. Why don't you investigate before you jump to conclusions?
You know, Casey, the same thing occurred to me, too. I did investigate.
Did you find out anything?
Not much. Laura Neely was making $55 a week. And last week, she buys $970 worth of dresses.
Well, so what? Every girl saves for clothes?
Oh, sure. But Laura's personal bank account was $200. She didn't touch that. And on top of the $970 for dresses, she spent $300 for two suits and bought $150 worth of luggage. When I got all those reports, I began to suspect that Laura might have been preparing for a trip.
How about the railroad and bus terminal?
Well, my boys checked them, but not a trace.
Well, you see, now.
But I had found the record of an automobile sale in her name. Yesterday, Laura bought a blue convertible roadster from a second-hand dealer. Today, she's gone.
She bought a car. Huh? Pick her up fast in a blue convertible. Not many of them on the road.
So we pick her up, then what? We put her on trial, and the whole story comes out. How she took the wise boys in town, the newspapermen and the police.
Oh, I know. I'll take the blame for that, Logan. The boys will be glad to pass the buck to me.
But, if you take all the blame...
What else can I do, Annie? I fell for a story. I introduced her around.
Well, it would be pretty hard to live it down.
Who's worried? Yeah, I can always get a job. Who says I've got to be a crime photographer? I can go around snapping baby pictures.
Captain Logan, I'm afraid for him.
You blow his top and then calm down.
Well, I'd better stay with him. In case he ever needed me, he needs me now.
I'm in a hurry, Ann.
Oh, now, Casey, I'm going with you.
Why should you?
Well, I've helped before.
I don't need any help. Sorry, Annie.
What a friend for.
Thanks, dear.
Wasn't I always?
Sure.
Thanks, Casey. Now, what are we going to do?
Gotta find that blonde.
Well, the police will pick her up.
Oh, sure they will. Sure. But I've got to get to her first, Annie. If this story ever gets in the paper...
Well, what can you do? Well,
the way I figure is, if Laura was getting ready to leave town, she might have got some hint of somebody.
Well, she doesn't have any family that we know of.
Her boss is probably closer to her than anybody else. She may have a lead to girlfriends or boyfriends. I'm going to call on Thomas Stevens right now.
Make yourselves comfortable in the library. I'll tell Mr. Stevens you're here.
Thank you.
If I may take your valise, sir.
Oh, that's all right. That's my film case. I'll set it down right here.
Mr. Stevens will be down directly.
Yeah, we'll wait, sir. Boy, the electrical line must pay off plenty.
Uh-huh. This is a lovely house. Oh, an original painting by Van Houten.
Oh, good evening. Do you like my wife's portrait?
Oh, good evening, Mr. Stevens. Your wife is a beautiful woman.
Oh, thank you. She's out of town right now, Miss...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Miss Williams, and this is Mr. Casey.
Oh, yes. I spoke to you on the phone, Mr. Casey.
Yes.
Do you have any news of Laura?
Yes, bad news.
You mean Laura's hurt?
No. Laura has run away with the money she collected for the city welfare fund.
Oh, it's impossible. I don't believe
it. Well, they had a pretty hard time convincing me, too. Can't argue about it anymore. Police found that Laura bought a flock of new clothes, luggage, and a car, and then she disappeared.
She did. And I...
You what?
I donated $300 to our fund myself.
You're a good, smart company, Mr. Stevens. Quite a few people like to catch up with Laura. And I'd like your help.
Well, what can I do?
Well, answer some questions, if you will. You see, the way we figure, Laura was with you during her working day, and she might have dropped a hint as to where she was going.
Nothing that I can remember, Mr. Casey.
Oh, did she ever say she wished you were in California, we'll say, or Florida, or someplace?
No, as a matter of fact, I know very little about her.
And there isn't anything you remember that could give us some lead.
I'm afraid not, much as I'd like to.
Oh, sorry to bother you, Mr. Casey.
Well, if I think of anything, I'll call you, Mr. Casey.
Yeah, thanks. You can reach me at the newspaper office.
Or perhaps the police will catch her.
Maybe. Yeah, but by that time, Laura Neely will have run through the money for the welfare fund. Here we go, Annie.
This time of year is full of financial hurdles, including bills, federal income tax, and keeping up with spiraling winter fuel costs. A well-deserved spring vacation would be great, but you just can't work it into your budget. Luckily, there's help right around the corner. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank will be delighted to chat with you. Their loan officers can help you arrange for a personal loan just when you need one the most. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or at the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC.
Visit with a complete bust.
Oh, I don't know about that.
What do you mean? Stevens didn't know a thing.
So he said. Come on, let's get into the car. Here
we are. Go ahead, Ann.
Okay.
Will you please tell me why you think Stevens knows something?
Stacy, I've got something I want to show you. Switch on the dashboard light.
Huh? All right, here it is.
Now, what do you think of this?
What? Tube of lipstick.
Well, look closer.
Well, let's see it. All right, I still think it's lipstick.
Of course, but it's strawberry lipstick. Get it?
Strawberry, huckleberry, raspberry. What difference does it make?
Oh, none to a man, I guess. But this is the lightest shade of lipstick made. It's used by very blonde women.
Keep talking.
You remember when I sat down on the couch? Well, I found this lipstick between the cushions. Huh? That shows that Laura was in Stephen's library recently.
Annie, you got Laura on the brain since you met her. Lipstick could belong to any blonde woman. It might even be Mrs. Stevens.
Didn't you notice that portrait of Stevens' wife? She's a brunette. Her shade would be deep red or purple.
True enough, but Mrs. Stevens might have dozens of blonde friends.
Stevens said his wife was out of town, didn't he? Well, none of her friends would come around when she's gone.
I still can't see it, though, Anne. All right, let's say for the sake of argument that I agree that Laura was in Stevens' library.
She was.
All right, does that make any sense? What'd she be doing there?
Oh, she might be in love with Stephen.
In love with... Well, all right. Now, let's see. Now, suppose he were planning to run out with Laura. So what does he do? He lets Laura steal the 10 grand which she collected for the welfare fund? Think, Annie. Stephen is a very rich man. 10,000 bucks doesn't mean very much to him. Why would he let Laura take the money and get the police after them?
Well, when you put it that way...
Well, sure, that's a fact. Stephen is no dope. How do you get around that?
Oh, I don't know, but I do know that this is Laura's lipstick.
How? What are your reasons?
When something is true, you don't need reasons.
Oh.
And I know this is Laura's lipstick. And if we could get back into Stephen's home, I'll bet that you'd find more clues that she was there.
What am I supposed to do? Tell Stephen that I think he's harboring Laura and search the house? Or shall I pull a gag about reading the gas meter?
All right, get sarcastic if you want to. But I'd get into that house if I wanted to find Laura.
Well, we could wait till Stephen's left the house. And I could walk in and tell the butler I left my film case behind.
Yeah, that's it. That'll give us a chance to examine the library again.
Well, okay, Annie. But I'm doing this for one reason.
Oh? What reason?
Your intuition was right once about Laura. And even if it's 1,000,000 to 1 against you being right again, I'm not leaving myself open.
That was Stevens in the car with
me. Yeah, I got a good look at him. He's
gone.
Okay. Good evening. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Casey, but Mr. Stevens left the house shortly after you did.
Oh, well, that's all right. I didn't come back to see Mr. Stevens. You see, I missed my film case, and I think I left it here.
Film case?
Yes, that square leather case with a leather strap that you want to take. You
know? Oh, yes, I remember, sir. Will you come in?
Yes, thank you. Happy you, Ernie.
You must have left the film case in the library, sir. I'll look.
I'll just come along, pick it up.
Here's the library, sir. Do you remember where you put it?
Well, it's too big to miss. It might be on the other side of the couch. Not here. Do you remember what I did with it, Annie?
Well, you might have shoved it under the couch. No, it isn't there.
Hey, what's that over there?
Hmm?
It wasn't here before. Oh, no, that's too big.
That's Mr. Stevens's overnight bag, sir.
Oh.
I placed it there after you left.
Oh, I see. Could anybody have picked up the film case after I left?
It was hardly possible, sir, but I'll ask the maid if you will.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd appreciate it.
It'll only be a few moments, sir.
It'll take as long as you want. Well, Annie, find anything more?
No. Here, Casey. What? Near the couch.
What do you mean? I don't see anything.
No.
Huh? You mean the perfume?
Yeah. And it's strongest near the couch. Laura sat here recently.
Some more intuition, Annie, or some logical reason this time?
Look, I'm sure, Casey. It's faint, but I'm sure it's twilight in Paris, Laura's perfume. I'm sure she was here.
Ah, that might fit in at that, Annie. Annie, I'll tell you what I'm going to do.
What?
Well, first, I'll take you home. Then I've got to prepare a speech to make to a tough guy. And then I got to buy a can of paint.
You're late, Tom.
I had to be careful driving up here, Paula. Where's Laura?
In the cabin.
Did she give you any trouble?
Everything went like we planned. She came to the house with some papers from you, and I offered her a drink. That stuff you put in the liquor kept her out cold.
And nobody could possibly have seen you put her in the car?
Nobody. All the servants had the day off.
Fine. All your friends, Paul. I must have told a million people that my wife is out of town for a few days.
This summer cabin of ours is certainly out of town.
Where's the blue convertible roadster you drove up?
In back of the fence, naturally. It can't be seen from the road.
Every policeman in the state is looking for that car.
Tom, how did it go in the city? Did the police accept the fact that Laura bought the car and the clothes with the welfare fund money?
They swallowed it, hook, line, and sinker. The blonde wig was an inspiration, Paula. Buying stuff in Laura's name wouldn't have been enough if you didn't fill her general description.
So they accepted the story exactly as we built it up.
Yes, I have from that newspaper photographer, Casey, that the police are convinced it was Laura who bought the car and the clothes with the fund money.
Good. And now that Laura is found dead...
Paula, we have to kill the girl. After all, it's not her fault that I carelessly left my second set of books on the desk.
What difference whether it's her fault or not? She did see the books, and she does know that you didn't pay nearly $1 million income tax.
I wish I hadn't listened to your Paula.
Don't be a fool, Tom. They'll send you to jail and think of me.
But to kill. Look, Paula, that's murder.
Tom, we can't take chances. If you had to pay fines on $1 million you held out, we'd be ruined. And you'd go to jail. Oh, no, Tom, I couldn't stand the disgrace.
Well, I don't like it, Paula.
Are you falling for her baby face, too? Well, I'll take care of her. I've got too much to lose. Come with that.
All right, put up your hands, both
Tom!
Of you. Sergeant Hunt, state police. Keep them covered, boys. Look in the back room. A guy named Casey said we'd find a beautiful blonde around here.
Casey, I'm just about to bust with curiosity.
Yeah, me too.
Goodness, Annie, doesn't your feminine intuition supply the answer?
All right. So I was wrong about Laura. I know that Mr. and Mrs. Stevens are under arrest, and that Laura is coming back with the money for the city welfare fund.
Casey, Miss Williams, here comes Laura now.
Oh, Mr. Casey, you saved my life. You got the police to Stevens' cabin just in time. Well, I could kiss you.
Well...
I was just getting ready to like you. Oh, I'm so excited, I don't know what I'm saying, Miss Williams. I sure thought I was a goner when I laid there tied up and Mr. and Mrs. Stevens talking about killing me. And everybody thought I had stolen the fund money. Except Mr. Casey, of course.
Well, there were moments when I had my doubts. But to give credit where it's due, it was Anne who spotted the lipstick and the perfume odor at Stevens' house.
Which started you off on a train of thought.
Sure. That and the fact that when we came back with a phony excuse, I saw that Stevens' bag was packed for a trip.
Yeah.
Well, so I decided to see where he went.
And that reminds me, when you left me, you said that you had to prepare a speech for a tough guy and buy a can of paint. Now, what did you mean?
Well, I knew that we'd make Stephen suspicious if we followed in a car, so I had to get a plane. Now, who would you say is the toughest guy in the world, Annie?
A city editor.
That's right, Burke. Well, I got our city editor to authorize the use of our news plane. And once I had that, I needed a can of paint to mark the top of Stephen's car so we could follow it.
Oh, I see.
A cub reporter phoned the airport when Stephen's left. Well, we spotted the marks on Stephen's car from the air and followed him to his summer cabin in the woods. From above, we could see the blue convertible hidden from the road. So I knew that Laura was there.
Well, how'd you let the police know?
Annie, have you forgotten? Our new Morning Express plane is equipped with two-way radios.
Oh, of course.
Well, there's your story, Annie. You better get back to the office with it.
Oh, there are a lot of things which I don't understand yet.
Huh?
How about coming up to the office while I write the story, Casey? Just to help a slow-witted pal.
Huh? Sure.
Oh, Miss Williams, I don't think you're slow-witted at all.
Crime Photographer, starring Scott Cotsworth as Casey, is brought to you each Thursday by the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation. makers of Fire King Oven Glass. Anchor glass containers, anchor caps and closures. All products of Anchor Hawking, the most famous name in glass.
Hearing that show again was a wonderful experience.
If your car has just about been making it through the winter, then drive into spring with a new car. Dealers are offering some great buys right now on remaining 1976 models, as well as new, more economical 77s. Visit one of the offices of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank division and ask them to help map out one of their convenient auto loans for you. They'll help you purchase that new car quickly and easily. And you'll get low-cost bank interest rates, too. At both Farmers and Mechanics and Cromwell Savings, you can count on friendly and accommodating service. So check into an automobile loan soon and drive into spring with that new car. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two. One at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you. Two in Middletown, and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC. And now back to Dick Bertel.
I want to remind our listeners that the Golden Age of Radio is coming to you tonight from the Park Plaza Hotel in New Haven, where the fifth annual convention of SAVE, the Society of American Vintage Radio Enthusiasts, is being held. This is Dick Bertel, along with Ed Corcoran, and our special guest, radio actor Stotz Cotsworth, who, by the way, was at one time known as radio's busiest actor. In 1946, for example, Stotz Cotsworth would begin his day with an 8:30 a.m. rehearsal for Lone Journey and end it after a repeat live performance for the West Coast audience of Mr. and Mrs. North, in which he played Lieutenant Bill Wigand. And, of course, between the two, he would appear in several soap operas. What a grueling schedule. Stotz, do you have any special recollections, any special stories about the show that you can share with us?
Now, I can tell you one story, which is interesting and somewhat sad. When the Polaroid camera first came out, John Dietz and I wrote a script in which Casey solved the whole crime by getting a picture in 60 seconds, you see, on his Polaroid. All right. So we used the word Polaroid. And we wrote the script, and we submitted it to the Polaroid people. They loved it. They adored it. And they asked CBS to do it, and CBS did, and they paid us for it, and so forth and so on. Well, now, the next thing we knew, we had communications from the Polaroid company in Boston, the Land Camera Company, which said, we are prepared to offer you one of two things. We are prepared to offer you a Polaroid Land camera or 15 shares of stock, if only we'd had enough brain.
You took the camera, I take it.
Yeah, we took the camera. The 15 shares of stock would be worth astronomical money.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you a photographer, or have you ever taken any pictures at all in your career?
Of course. As soon as I got into this business of Casey crime photography, I got terribly interested in photography because I'm an artist to begin with, and I was a painter, and I needed photography to help me as a documentary for paintings, you see. So I used to use it, and the more I did, the more I learned about it, and the more I learned about it, the more I loved it. And I had a couple of one-man shows of photography. Then I'd had one-man shows of painting, too. But the main thing was that for quite a long while, I stuck with the photography. I loved the photography.
In the Casey itself, I seem to recall that Johnny Gibson, who played Ethelbert, was with you from the very beginning. Is that right?
Yes.
And wasn't the first writer Alonzo Dean Cole? How did you rate him as a writer for your particular series?
Well, he stank. I loved him, but I thought he stank as a writer. He couldn't write dialogue to save his life. It was too complicated. I mean, his dialogue read like, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to translate his dialogue into readable words. It's all right. We love John Alonzo Dean Cole. And remember, this show was on the air for 11 years, 11 solid years. We had three or four different leading ladies, one of whom was Jan Minor, of course, but that was later. Betty Furness was one. Leslie Woods.
And, of course, you had all the top talent as far as supporting actors that came, you know, would play one show and then they'd be out for a few weeks.
Speaking of that, when World War II was over, who came marching home with two busted feet? The dear old Art Carney. He had high boots on, and he was in these casts and everything, and he'd stepped on a landmine or some goddamn thing, and it was just terrible. And the poor guy, it was taking him months and months and months to get rid of this, you know. But it didn't matter. He came in, and he took it all in his stride, and Johnny Deeds, the director, loved Art. We all did. And even if there wasn't a good part for him, even if there was no part at all, we would write one in. We'd write a part in, and Artie would come in, and he'd be a barfly, you see, and he played this most marvelous drunk. Have you ever heard his drunk?
I believe I had on the Jackie Gleason show. I think he did it a few times, yes.
Just a beautiful drunk as you ever heard in your life. And he was always coming into the bar, Ethelbert, I just want my usual pleasure with a little piece of pineapple. And, you know, that was about all he had to do. But we loved him.
Every episode had at least one scene, and probably several, in a bar, with Herb Chittison, the Blue Note pianist.
Herman Chittison.
And our ever faithful bartender. And I don't think any other show had that kind of a locale where every week you'd be in there for a quick pop there somewhere along the day.
And people seem to accept that. They seem to accept that. There was never too much drinking. There was never even any suggestion that anybody drank too much except some, you know, ridiculous character like Artie Carney was playing. Nobody suggested that anybody really seriously drank too much.
Yeah, I don't ever remember you even ordering a drink, to tell you the truth. He may have been in the bar,
yes,
but...
Yeah, we had a euphemism for that. It was Ethelbert, a short one.
That's what you got.
Yeah. And that could be a short beer, which it usually was, you know.
Do you recall, again, any of the cases that were really stick in your mind where the... you mentioned one about the Polaroid camera. Are there any others that came to mind? Any way-out plots or anything like that?
No. Actually, one doesn't remember those things particularly well because we don't make too much of them. I mean, in other words, people lose their interest if it gets too complicated. If the plot gets too complicated, they lose their interest and they go away from you. My God, I used to do loads and loads and loads of shows like this, like The Shadow, Gangbusters, all this stuff.
I remember I heard an interview with Matt Crowley, who did Buck Rogers, and he didn't remember even half the members of the regular cast. It didn't linger with you like doing a play or something like that, where you did the same thing over and over.
I remember from Matt with a show on ABC called Ma Trail, which was on for quite a long while.
House Jameson, I think, wasn't he on Ma Trail?
No. House had nothing to do with that.
I guess I was thinking of Renfrew the Mounted. I guess I got my shows mixed up.
I don't know how you remember all these things. I've lost them half the time.
Well, I remember you did another show called X Minus One, and which...
I don't remember that at all.
You and Johnny Gibson are doing a role again, and I'd like to play that for you tonight. Would you like to hear it and see what
I'd
it sounds
love
like?
To hear it, yeah.
All right, why don't we play it now? This is Stotts Cotsworth in X Minus One.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, presents
X minus one.
Tonight's story, The Castaways, by Ernest Kinoy. In the South Pacific, night comes on rapidly. The sun dips below the flat horizon, the sea is crimson for a moment, and then night falls. But on Tahani Atoll, giant arc lights turn night into day. Across the waters of the lagoon, within the barrier reef, launches and tugs skitter back and forth. While on the curving half-moon of the island, army trucks and jeeps scuttle down the rough roads bulldozed by the Seabees just 6 weeks ago. A low Quonset hut stands near the beach, surrounded by tangled wire. This is the preliminary command post. And inside is General Frank Gaydosh, field director of the test. Operation Destruction.
Everything's on schedule, General. Radiological surveys complete. Instruments placement checked.
Well, get me Navy and tell them H hour is as ordered. Send a periodic time check to Air Force on 90-week tuck and observation control on the Missouri.
Yes, sir.
I want a complete roster check on all personnel before H hour.
Yes, sir. Oh, Nate Cohen wants to see you.
Well, who the devil's he?
AP man. He's been selected by the press radio pool to interview.
I haven't got any time. Tell him to speak to Major Dwight Breedenberg. He's the PRO.
I think perhaps you'd better see him, sir. The directive on public relations from Washington was very clear.
Well, how in blazes am I supposed to run a bomb test and play mother hen to a bunch of reporters?
Washington said...
All right, all right. Bring him in. Borelli?
Yes, sir.
Give me some black coffee, will you?
Yes, sir. This is Mr. Cohen, General Gator.
How do you do, General?
Lousy, as a matter of fact.
Is that an official statement?
No. You can run some of that. The world is at the crossroads, baloney.
I wrote that yesterday. General, what effect do you think the new bomb will have on the world situation?
I can't tell you that, even if I knew. My job is to set the blasted thing off and see that nobody gets hurt and collect the data.
Can I speak to you a moment, sir?
Later, Alan. Go ahead, Cohen.
Can you release anything on the scientific principles involved?
I don't even understand them myself. Wait a minute. Dr. Muller?
Yes?
Come over here a minute, will you? Cohen, this is Dr. Fred Muller, civilian scientific director. He's the only one who knows what's inside that warhead.
How do you do, Mr. Cohen?
How about a statement, Doctor?
Oh, I'm afraid all I'm allowed to say is that the bomb is new, it's extremely powerful, and off the record, it's very tricky and dangerous.
What'll happen if it goes off prematurely?
I don't think we have to worry about that. In fact, we wouldn't even know about it, if you'll excuse me.
Now, how about the natives?
Well, what about them?
Aren't they going to be evacuated from the island?
They already have been.
General Gaydosh.
Well, I saw the Tahani chief outside when I came in. The whole tribe squatting down at the motor pool having a conference.
What? Alan.
I've been trying to tell you, sir. The Tahani are still on the island.
Well, why? The LCTs are ready, aren't they?
Yes, sir, but they won't go. They refuse.
The schedule called for their evacuation to Mailani 3 hours ago.
I realize that, sir, but I hoped we could still get them off without violence.
Look, Alan, they're either on the island or off. Now, wait a minute. Cohen, that's all.
What are you going to do about the natives, General?
Never mind, I'll issue a statement later.
You going to force them?
Go on, get out. I haven't got time.
All right, General, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Spring is officially here. If 1977 is the year that you plan some improvements to your home or property, stop in soon and chat with the folks at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Perhaps that much-needed family room is tops on your priority list. Maybe it's a dormer and the enlarging of those upstairs bedrooms you've been contemplating, or a new patio or driveway. Whatever the reason, get complete information on a home improvement loan now. You'll find Cromwell Savings Bank located at the corner of Main and West Streets and the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell, with convenient Saturday hours, 9 to noon. And Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. With the exception of the Middletown office on Main Street, they're also open Saturdays from 9 to noon. Visit them soon. Let them show you how a home improvement loan can help you. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lenders.
We are speaking to Stutz Cotsworth here at the SAVE Convention in New Haven. Stutz Cotsworth, as you all know, was Casey crime photographer and, of course, many, many other roles in both radio and television. Did you do any kind of a continuing role in the television at all?
You mean daytime television?
Daytime or even evening.
You mean like Edge of Night or something like that?
Yeah, those are pretty difficult things to act on.
I just can't do them because I don't believe in them. They're the cheapest, lousiest dialogue. They don't mean a damn thing. The actors, bless their hearts, are making a living, but they don't like what they're doing. I think it's very sad. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't have to, and I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is your present situation in Stutz? How do you spend it, other than your lovely wife, who is Josephine Hutcherson, who was quite a movie star, and I think she was in North by Northwest, and she was in many other films. You still do acting on occasion, but you're more or less just taking things easy, I take it, huh?
Yes, yes. I would like to think that I'm semi-retired. On the other hand, somebody swept me up into a radio series.
Have you done any of the CBS Mystery Theater at all? How do you like doing that again, being back in harness?
I love it. I love it. I haven't done one for about 2 months, but I love them because I love High Brown. The thing that I like about High is he's loyal. And he has reasonably good taste. And I enjoy working with him. I just enjoy it, that's all. He's fun and he's jolly and so forth. Now, this new one I've got is it's called The Faces of Love. And it's on WOR as part of a one-hour block of 15 minutes.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that, yes.
Shows, mm-hmm. You see. I enjoy this because I enjoy working with my old friends. I like to go to the studio and what the hell we do? We do a 15-minute show in exactly 1 hour. So if I have two to do, I got 2 hours work, and I go home, and that's peachy. Hello, my darling love. We have to cut.
Okay, we're getting a word from our director here, Ms. Hutcherson, that we're running out of time, so we'll have to call an end to this interview with Stutz Cotsworth, our Casey crime photographer, and lots of luck, no matter what comes
down
the pipe.
Thank you.
Thanks for the audience here.
Oh, no, not.
You're going to get out of the studio.
I don't know how you get it. Come in.
Stutz is off to address a seminar on the subject of old-time radio here at the SAVE Convention. But it was great fun having him for the past hour to reminisce with us. The Golden Age of Radio with special guest Stutz Cotsworth came to you tonight from the Park Plaza Hotel in New Haven, where SAVE, the Society of American Vintage Radio Enthusiasts, is meeting for its fifth annual convention. The program X-1 was from the collection of David Siegel Radio Archives. Now, until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
And this is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sherago and Dick Bertel.
Rinse all white and rinse all bright.
Strike program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and Lillian.